and you started a process. We are in the middle of that process now, where after we allowed the public to comment from the 19th of July to the 26th, there are those who thought they want to be here physically. When I say physically, talk to us. And I think we are allowing that opportunity. So we'll allow them one by one to make presentations. As indicated earlier, my training says if you want to talk sense, you can't exceed 15 minutes talking to people who you expect them to note what you are saying. So I would say at most 15 minutes each presenter, 10 if possible, would appreciate that. And for now, I'm not sure about the approach. Maybe we allow all of them to make presentations. Then we ask questions for clarity, for whatever, as members of parliament. And I'll be guided by yourselves there. So I don't want to come in. I'm coming in here for the first time. If you want to comment after each presentation, or we allow all of them to do that, we'll do that. But let's do the basic things that must be done before a meeting proceeds. Can I ask the PC secretary to indicate who has apologized?
Good morning, everybody. We have received apologies from Honorable Hadebe. He'll be attending the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence meeting. We also have an apology from Honorable Maggie Clow. She's still on sick leave. And then the minister will unfortunately not be able to honor the meeting due to NCCC meeting today. The Deputy Minister Bakela will not be able to attend the meeting due to attending the inauguration of the newly appointed Northwest Premier. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
I've also seen in the messages that some members would like their behalf. But we noted it in the WhatsApp group that some members would want to leave early. Can I get a proposal? There are a few things I've proposed. So the presenters would be this one for SA. I've proposed 10 minutes, HSF, 10 minutes. S.A. Hunters, am I leaving anybody? So those, but I've made proposals to say there should be time limit in terms of that, and I've also said, do we take all of them and ask questions after that? And immediately you have commented on those. Can I get a proposal for the adoption of the agenda? Honourable members, I don't seem to see any hand. Oh, I see Honourable Direko.
Thank you, Chair. I move for adoption of the agenda, and I will request that you allow all of them to present, and thereafter we'll then go to the discussion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Brink.
Good morning, Chairperson. I agree with the proposal that we give a 10 minutes to each of the organisations who are presenting, or at least a reasonable time limit so that we can hear all of the voices. We do have the benefit of the written presentations as well. I think there might just be one or two organizations that you have left out But I think if the rule is consistent, everybody who is here to make submissions will get the opportunity and will stick to the time. Thank you.
Thank you. I assume the agenda has been adopted. Then let's immediately move to the first presenter. Unfortunately, I just see the abbreviations here, something that says for SA. The person will be able to introduce himself or herself and proceed with the presentation. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm the Council of Freedom of Religion, South Africa, OFOSI, and I have with me today Attorney Daniela Elabek, who is our legal advisor and will be sharing our brief presentation. If I may, just for the benefit of everybody on the call, screen share. Is it visible?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. All right. So, start then. All right. So, Freedom of Religion South Africa, or FOSA, is a legal advocacy organization. We work specifically to protect and promote the constitutional right to religious freedom and the rights of religious communities in South Africa. Importantly, as an organization, we are faith and doctrinally neutral. In other words, we don't protect a particular faith group or their particular doctrines. We rather focus on protecting the constitutional right and principle of religious freedom. We've been around for a number of years, since 2014, and since that time we have engaged both with Parliament and with the Executive on policies, on bills. We also get involved in various cases before courts, right up until the Constitutional Court, to protect religious freedom. Importantly, let me just skip there. So there are the different arenas we are involved in. But of particular importance here is that over the last year and a half in particular, FOSA has been actively involved in making submissions to and engaging with both government and parliament, and including this COGTA committee in particular, on the COVID-19 regulations issued in terms of the Disaster Management Act and the impact thereof on the religious sector of South Africa. And in this, FOSA has been mandated by religious leaders and organizations representing between 11 million and 18.5 million people from a cross-spectrum of churches, denominations, and faith groups, specifically then to engage both government and parliament and to make submissions on their behalf. What is then our interest in this specific bill? So, because this engagement in the last year and a half, FOSA has a good understanding of the Disaster Management Act, its purposes and its provisions, and we are acutely aware of the actual and the potential radical and often detrimental impact of the Act as it currently stands on various fundamental rights, as COVID-19 and the various regulations directed issued in terms of the Act in this regard have clearly demonstrated. So our interest in the bill lies therein that the Act as it currently stands has been used to directly limit various constitutional rights and freedoms, including specifically the right to religious freedom in section of religious communities in Section 31, Red Section. And this has been done in most instances without proper public consultation and or provision for proper parliamentary oversight over what is effectively subordinate legislation. Now, the committee will remember also that during December 2020 and January 2021, this limitation on the constitutional rights of religious persons and communities even took the form of a complete ban on religious gatherings throughout the country. This, when other gatherings, as for instance casinos, cinemas, gyms, and restaurants, were allowed to continue. Now, this singling out of the religious sector was viewed as unfair discrimination by government against the religious sector, and it's indeed also the subject matter of pending litigation against government before the Johannesburg High Court, which case is coming up for hearing in November 2021. As was recently stated by the Supreme Court of Appeal in the East Shore case against the COGTA minister, and I quote, "Even in times of national crisis, as this undoubtedly is, the executive has no free hand to act as it pleases, and all of the measures it adopts in order to meet the exigencies of the nation's crisis must be rooted in law and comply with the Constitution. The rule of law, a founding value of our Constitution, applies in times of crisis as much as it does in more stable times. And against this background, Honourable Chair and Committee Members, we do believe that the Act as it currently stands needs amending, and in principle, therefore, we do support the DMA Amendment Bill. We do, however, have some recommendations for the further strengthening of the bill as set out in 4SA's written submission on the bill, which we will briefly refer you to. However, I am now going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Danella Elebek. She will focus on 4SA's broad submissions, but we have provided, as I said, the committee with a written submission in which we also propose how particular clauses should be amended in order to reflect our broad submission. So I'm going to hand over to my colleague for the next few minutes. Danella?
Good morning, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to address you. As Nadine stated, 4SA is of the view that the aim of the bill is laudable, namely to increase parliamentary oversight in circumstances where, as she has said, fundamental rights have been limited, including the fundamental rights in sections 15, 18 and 31 of the Constitution, as well as the fact that it's been no secret that both Parliament and the public have struggled to effectively engage with and be considered, with the considered by the executive. But it's imperative that the existing Act, as well as public consideration, for as long as either the current state of disaster continues or in the event of a future state of national, provincial or local disaster. Turning to the specific recommendations, we believe that it should be made compulsory for the executive, in other words, the minister in a state of national disaster, or the premier in the state of a provincial disaster, or the municipal council in the state of a local disaster, to engage with the public, for example, by publishing proposed regulations for comment. In this regard, Nadine Bonnell did refer to the ESOL case, which also held that PARJA, the Promotion of Access to Justice Act, applies to regulations issued by the Cabinet Minister, and that she is obliged to follow a fair public participation process. And this also entails that the public, and by implication Parliament, has a legal right to know on what grounds and for what reasons fundamental rights are limited. To this end, we submit that the Act should make it compulsory for the executive to provide Parliament with the scientific reasons and or data upon which it's basing its proposed regulations. It should also be compulsory for the executive to provide Parliament with a record of any meetings that it had regarding the drafting of the proposed regulations. And all of these are necessary in order to provide Parliament with the necessary information it needs to effectively perform its oversight function of the executive and hold the executive to account as contemplated by our Constitution. We also believe that the bill could further be strengthened by empowering Parliament, whether it's the National Assembly in the event of a national disaster or the Provincial Parliament in the event of a provincial disaster, to have further public consultations should be of the view that the executive consultations were insufficient. And then also, given the context of the current Act and how it's been used to limit fundamental rights, we also believe it should be necessary for Parliament to debate whether, one, the proposed regulations are rationally connected to the science and data that the executive has handed over to Parliament, two, whether the proposed regulations limit any fundamental rights protected in the Bill of Rights, and three, whether, if there is such a limitation, these limitations are reasonable and justifiable in accordance with Section 36 of the Constitution. Thank you for giving us your time and for listening to us and our proposals. As we needed full proposed clauses for the Constitution, these are just broad strokes. We look forward to answering your questions, any questions that the committee may have.
Can we said we'll ask questions at the end. Can we now ask for HSF? We will try to include everybody as was suggested HSF, can we get your presentation? HSF. Now that I don't seem to hear HSF, can we move to South African Hunters? Your 10 minutes.
Good morning, sir, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm not that knowledgeable about Zoom. I sent you a copy of the presentation. Just want to make sure whether you received it.
Yes, we did.
Is it necessary for me to attempt to screen share, or can I just work through it as you have the presentation with you?
Whatever that suits you. I think we do have a copy. We will just open our copies.
Thank you, sir. Then I would prefer just to talk you through the presentation as it was submitted. Thank you very much for the opportunity and your patience. And being prepared to hear us on this one. Theta Hunters is an association of largely consumptive hunters that was formed in 1949. We represent 44,267 members. They live and operate in 82 branches all over the country, and I've given you a brief overview of the country to show where these branches are located. As consumptive hunters, we hunt to use the meat. There was a time when this was commonly known as hunting for biltong, a time when venison was used just to make biltong is long gone. Venison is used as a source of protein by the majority of hunters that go hunting. We regularly have research done, and largely by the Northwest University, the Unit for Tourism Society, is commonly known as TREE. There are about 300,000 consumptive hunters in the country, and these are people who want to use meat as protein. From the research done by this unit, the annual contribution to the South African economy of consumptive hunting is in excess of 12 billion per annum, 12,000 million rand per annum. Trophy hunting, when people hunt to collect the trophies, and these are mostly foreign hunters that would visit the country, contributes about 2.5 billion, while the life game of sales contributes about 6 billion. That number is going down since the numbers or the prices of some of the color variants have dropped significantly. If you add all of this together, the game and hunting industry contributes somewhere between 18 and 20 billion rand per annum to the South African economy. The biggest portion here of by far is contributed by consumptive hunters, and it is spent in semi-rural areas or semi-arid rural areas where game farming is done. Game farming is largely done in the drier parts of the country, and this is where that money is spent. The hunting season classically lasts during the months that I have so far, May, June, July, and August every year. It may be earlier and later as well, so it may happen that on some farms that are exempted, you may start hunting as early as March, and you may continue as late as October. Outside these periods, it gets too warm. The total lockdown was introduced from April 2020. Right from the word go, agriculture was exempted. However, hunting, which is also an agricultural activity, was locked down and not allowed. Later on, hunting was allowed, locked down again, and allowed again. The net result thereof is that we lost more than half of the hunting season. Now, you may very well ask me, how does it come that you describe hunting as an agricultural activity. Hunting is largely the activity by means of which game farmers harvest their product. It's done by hunters, nothing more. In 2021, we had the level 4 lockdown and hunting was initially again closed down. The damage of hunting in the first 3 months in 2020 was actually calculated by the research unit of the Northwest University. In August this year, last month, they reported in the Global Ecology and Conservation Journal that the game and hunting industry lost $4.61 billion in the period March to May 2020. This is the 3 months period with a total lockdown we had last year, the initial lockdown. So just those 3 months resulted in the 4.6 billion rands in economic contribution lost to the country. So what is the impact hereof? According to the research of Trees, the wages of 33% of the employees in the industry were reduced. 21% of the employees in the industry were required to take unpaid leave. 19% of the employees in the industry were laid off. They lost their jobs. No less than 18,000 jobs were lost. It's also estimated that this impact would last for a further 2 to 4 years. The impact of the lockdown was massive. So the view of SA Hunters on the amendment or the proposed amendment of the Disaster Management Act is actually very simple. We plead for a more inclusive process when taking political decisions on disaster management. There must be proper oversight of decisions taken. There must be wider consultation with bodies representing the industries. And there must be understanding of the economic implication of decisions taken. I told you that the calculated number of jobs lost from the research done by Trees is about 18,000 people that lost their jobs in the first 3 months of the lockdown last year. Now, on average, for every one person employed, they sustain 6 people in the family. So it's the person employed plus 5 others that live from the income generated in this industry. So you can multiply the 18,000 people that lost their jobs by 6 to get to the number of people that may be without jobs and food now as a result of that decision taken. And because of this impact, the view of SA Hunters is that we support the proposed amendments to the Disaster Management Act to ensure oversight by Parliament and to the bodies representing industries and on decisions taken prior to those decisions taken and the economic harm being done afterwards. Very short and simple, sir, but those are the views that we would like to share with your committee. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. We will ask questions at the end. Can I now call on NUMSA to present their position? NUMSA?
Thank you, Chair. I'm just trying to share my screen. I don't know it anyway. Right. So good morning to the committee members, good morning Chair, and morning to the honourable members of this committee. As NUMSA, we would like to share our submission and our deliberations that we'd like to make in relation to the disaster management of. I'm just going to share my screen with you. I don't know, is it visible?
Not yet.
Okay. Share screen. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. So, Chair, as Mr. Wagner would like to mention in this submission is that, as we are aware as a country, we've been faced with numerous amounts of challenges as a result of lockdown. We've noticed the increase in employment, unemployment, and we've seen that in the recent statistics that's been released by SSA, looking at a 34.4% unemployment rate and an expanded rate of 44.4%. And what is also very worrying, Jay, is also the socioeconomic effects that the various lockdowns is having on the country and had on the country. If we look at also the recent stats about the Department of Health release about the number of increasing teenage pregnancies, this is just one of the many socioeconomic problems that we're seeing faced in the country. And also noting, Chair, that, you know, South Africa being the highest in terms of unemployment, inequality and poverty, with a Gini coefficient sitting at 63, it's just unbearable for a society to continue on this trajectory. And therefore, at NUSA, we would like to say that we know that the Management Act would permit the National Assembly to extend the state of disaster for no more than 3 months at a time. However, the National Assembly is not required to consult with organized labor on the National Disaster Advisory or the National Disaster Advisory Board. In the light of this change, we are therefore strongly opposed to these amendments that has been stated out, purely for the reasons that we've mentioned earlier, the socioeconomic reasons, the declining of society that we have seen, and even as we note that, you know, the very little jobs that is available, one worker in a family actually supports 6 other additional family members. So the multiplier effect of this, the national disaster implications, you know, it improves on people's freedom of movement, for them even to be able to have an income. So it is based on those reasons, Chair, that the state of disaster disproportionately affects the rights and interests of our citizens. During the period of lockdown, we've noted that some sectors were chosen to be left open, for example, the mining sector, and other sectors chose to remain closed. This definitely affected the way we did things, the way society actually had to be able to perform and make an income. The informal sector was gravely devastated because society that tries to make an income informally was therefore unable to do so. So based on the different socioeconomic statuses, Chair, the middle class were more easily able to survive, during the lockdown period, whereas the unemployed and the poor were not able to do so. Even the current infrastructure and living arrangements were not sustainable enough for them to even have the concept of social distancing being, you know, implemented. So the state of disaster should be strictly circumscribed, and therefore we say that it should be restricted and limited given the impact of the disaster on the exercise of the constitutional right and freedom of movement. We're saying that the extension of the state of disaster by up to 3 months at a time constitutes a serious intrusion to the rights of the citizens, and it is an element of no consultation. There must be consultation first required, and therefore we cannot comprehend, as NUSA, why before extension of a state of disaster, the National Assembly is not required to consider representation from citizens or their representatives who are directly affected of the members of the National Assembly and consider not only business but take into account the interests of other members of society. And we therefore say that other members of society and members of parliament are not impoverished and do not experience the daily realities and struggles of the working class. And therefore, we put to this committee that accordingly, at the very least, when this extension of the state of disaster, before the extension of the state of disaster, the National Assembly should be required to consult either with the National Advisory Management Forum, which includes organized labor, alternatively with the NEDLAC or any other trade union federations which are not members of NEDLAC. And in closing, Chair, we would like to say that in from the preamble of the South African Constitution is that we need to respect those who have worked to build and develop our country. This is from the South African Constitution. Because our rights as citizens and workers that form broader part of society have been highly restricted and highly, you know, disadvantaged in a way that they cannot be able to move, both in the formal sector, the informal sector, and other multiplier things. So on that note, yeah, that is our submission as the National Union of Metal Workers. And my name, I forgot to tell you, Chair, is Melanie Roy from the National Union of Metal Workers Economic Research and Policy Institute. And we will be happy to share any details or questions that need to be asked. Thank you, Chair. Thank you to this committee for the opportunity.
I'm sorry, I think my network had a problem. I assume, can we now call on Disaster Management Institution of Southern Africa?
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. The name is Owen Becker. I'm the Deputy President of the Disaster Management Institute of South Africa, which is a professional body for disaster management in South Africa. And we thank you for the opportunity to comment on the draft bill. We are of the opinion that the draft bill is in contrast to what the actual spirit of the law or the Disaster Management Act is. And if we look at the preamble to the Disaster Management Act, it is to provide an integrated and coordinated disaster management policy that focuses on preventing and reducing the risk of disasters, mitigating the severity of disasters, emergency preparedness, rapid and effective response to disasters and post-disaster recovery and rehabilitation. Now, the current submission that we have is only addressing three aspects which relate to the post-disaster response. It is not addressing any of the other 65 sections of the Act, which speak primarily to the pre-disaster planning and prevention. The purpose of the legislation is to ensure that the risk reduction and rapid response is provided to potential disasters and disasters. And as each disaster is unique and must be addressed in the evolving merits of the situation, there must be sufficient flexibility for this to take place. And this is evidenced by the more than 200 regulations that were promulgated by several ministers following the National Declaration of a State of Disaster to manage the COVID-19 pandemic. The fact that the regulations and directions could be quickly adjusted based on the lessons learned with earlier versions is testament to the effectiveness and the utility of enabling legislation. And I think many of the arguments that are forwarded by the presenters today do not actually recognize legislation adjustments to take place rapidly. the Institute recognizes the importance for accountability, but cautions that it should not hamper the rapid and effective management of disasters where life, property, and the environment is at stake. It also needs to address the functioning of communities and ensure that we do not disrupt them unnecessarily. I think what is not recognized is the impact that the measures actually had on curtailing the disease. We focus a lot, and many of the presentations do this, on the negative impacts that it's had on sectors of the community and the economy. We have had 2,800,000 infections in the country, and we've had 83,000 deaths. What would this have been had many of these measures not been put in place as early as they had is difficult to say. But it does bear testament if you compare to other countries with similar size populations. South Africa has done exceptionally well. And the fact that we have adapted according to the prevailing circumstances is also evidence that there has been a constant monitoring and adaptation of the legislation to suit the position as it was occurring. To only address the declaration aspects, which are Section 27 for national disasters, Section 41 for provincial disasters, and Section 55 for local disasters, is adding a bureaucratic process that will only result in delays and is not conducive to rapid response and adaptation to the conditions of a disaster. The proposal that there be a 60% majority for the adoption of resolutions and the need for public debate is also unnecessary, time-consuming, and will just add to the process. What has been missed, and this is where oversight is very important, and oversight in place in terms of the full Disaster Management Act and the Disaster Management Policy Framework, we would not have had many of the ad hoc decisions that had to be taken at the spur of the moment based on the circumstances as they presented. What the Act actually requires is that there should be comprehensive assessment of potential disasters and particularly the consequences that will arise. And each and every national, provincial, and local government department, as well as civil society, needs to ensure that they have conducted adequate risk assessments to address those potentials and have taken the necessary measures and conducted the necessary planning to ensure that the potential consequences will be mitigated or prevented. Now that is the key, Chair, to dealing with this. And South Africa is currently not only dealing with the pandemic, but since 2009 we have been facing a constant situation of drought that has occurred at various places and in various provinces over that period of time. Chair, what is very important as well is that slow onset disasters such as epidemics or pandemics, drought and famine extend for many months and years, and consideration should in fact be given to extending the 3-month declaration in the case of these disasters rather than reducing the validity period. What we also want to conclude by saying is that the focus must be on addressing the potential consequences. There must be risk assessments, and we need to base our planning on scientific facts and figures. We had a pandemic just over 100 years ago, and we've repeated many of the flaws that we encountered there because we have not learned from previous disasters. And in conclusion, we want to say that at this point in time, we feel that the focus should be on addressing the immediate needs of the COVID-19 pandemic, and that we must not move our focus away from that. And this is contained in Section 4 of the Disaster Management Policy Framework, is that we need to conduct a disaster revision, and this must be a comprehensive revision of all the lessons that have been learned throughout this pandemic and in fact throughout any disaster or near disaster. And reports need to be prepared. And Chair, I want to propose as well that we are now 6 years since 2015 when the Amendment Act was promulgated. It is time to take stock, and there are other aspects of the Act that also need to be addressed. Let us take these lessons that we have learned, take stock of what can be done and should be done, and let's realign our legislation accordingly. But addressing just the three aspects at this stage would be an exercise in futility. We thank you for the time that you've given us.
Thank you. Can we now move to Professor Du Plessis and Professor Van Niekerk? I'm not sure if they are presenting at the same time. Professor Du Plessis and Professor Van Niekerk.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity. I don't think Professor Du Plessis will join us at this stage. She's got other commitments, so therefore I will do our presentation. Thank you much for the opportunity. I think I just want to start off with giving you all a brief background. My name is, like I said, Dewald van Niekerk. I'm a professor in disaster risk reduction at Northwest University. I'm also head of the African Center for Disaster Studies, and I've been very fortunate in being involved in the original drafting of the Disaster Management Bill from the year 1999 until it was promulgated, and then also the National Disaster Management Framework. So I do have quite extensive knowledge of the history of where we came from and the intent of the legislation. So first and foremost, I just want to highlight, I think, the main issue of oversight. I think that is what the main submission of this amendment is all about. If you look at the history, there's since the very first parliamentary discussions on this and the public hearings on the very first disaster management bill, that was one of the main concerns, was oversight within the system, for the simple reason that the Disaster Management Act as it currently stands contains two major elements. The one is that it has an element of emergency legislation to it, and then it has everyday implementation as in terms of the emergency legislation, we all know that it gives the responsible minister significant powers to do certain things. It's all highlighted in the Act, and it also therefore infringes on certain civil liberties. That being said, what we need to take cognizance of, and always remember, that if we are in a national state of disaster, it means we need to implement certain extraordinary measures. However, this must be done within the Constitution, and must be done within recognition of the Bill of Rights and within the liberties that we have within the democracy. And I think that was, has always been, according to my perception, the driving force between the Disaster Management Act. And that is to ensure that a situation that has or could be beyond our control is managed properly, and that we do implement certain measures in that line, whether it be a slow or a rapid onset event. Now, since the first inception of the Disaster Management Bill, the process that we followed was also not a smooth one. Some of you that have been members of Parliament back then will remember that the Disaster Management Bill was delayed for approximately 3 years because of the crossing the floor legislation and discussions that happened within Parliament. So it had a quite a rough start to it. And I believe right at the start in that process, some of the elements was missed that has now shown to be a major issue. And I will highlight some of these retrospectively, which I believe is something that we need to address going forward, and hopefully will then also address some of the issues that we currently sit with. So first and foremost, in terms of emergency legislation, the component that the Disaster Management Act exhibits or has currently gives these powers to the minister, but it's also linked to certain sunset clauses. And the 30 days, interesting enough, that we now have in the legislation was quite debated within Parliament as well. And the question was asked, why 30 days specifically? And the main reason behind that was looking at the type of hazards that we sit with within South Africa, and drought being a slow onset hazard that could go into to many years. The logic behind that was, well, let's link this declaration of a national state of disaster to something that could be longitudinal, something that might occur on a yearly basis and something that might run over years. And what would be the period that we need in order to implement, as the Act says, extraordinary measures to mitigate the circumstances or to reduce the risk, and therefore we sit with that component. However, the sunset clause is also, which allows for the state of disaster, it doesn't matter on which level we are talking about. That being said, in our submission we believe that learning from the COVID-19 pandemic, that we might need to look at including more oversight in terms of that 30-day period, and that 30-day period might be referred to Parliament for discussion before it is renewed, if time allows for that, because we never know in which type of situation we find ourselves, but we do welcome the submission in terms of more parliamentary oversight. That being said, to take you back to where we came from, it is our submission, it's my belief, that the Disaster Management Act has not been implemented to the full extent of its initial intention. And that is that we do have a National Disaster Management Center. We did develop a National Disaster Management Policy Framework, which I don't think a lot of people are aware of or have read, because that contains quite a lot of how disaster risk management should be implemented in South Africa. But it also contains other oversight structures, as alluded to in the Act, and which is quite well spelled out in the policy framework, and that is the Interdepartmental Committee on Disaster Management, which I believe should fulfill its oversight role. As far as I know, this committee has never actually fulfilled its role, and therefore I think it is prudent for us to rather consider allowing this committee to be constituted or to take up its role and to fulfill its duties as per the Disaster Management Act. That would also go quite far in fulfilling the oversight role, especially if you look at the composition. That being said, the Disaster Risk Management Act, Disaster Management Act is quite clear on the devolution of powers up to provincial and then even our local level, and the oversight role that different committees must be playing. I've done quite extensive research in the past 20 years relating to local government and disaster management, and it's clear that on local level and on district level, disaster management as per the Act is not being implemented as it should. There needs to be an advisory forum which brings together the public, interested groups, knowledgeable individuals, etc., to discuss disaster risk issues. And that is, this is not happening. It has not been happening for the past 20-odd years. Therefore, I believe more political oversight and implementation should happen when it comes to these forums up to local government level. The last point that I would like to make is the placement of the disaster risk management centres. A lot of the issues that we now sit with, I believe, is because of the totally wrong placement of the different centres. And white paper process on disaster management. One of the main elements that was mentioned was the establishment of a National Disaster Management Center. That occurred in 1999, and they were functional across the Y2K problem that we had. However, this center was always seated within local government, or COCTA as it is now. And the idea was that the National Disaster Management Center, as we see in so many other countries, are seated within the highest political office, being the presidency. And therefore, the idea has always been if I can say, well, not in writing, but the idea behind it was that the minister within the presidency would be responsible for the National Disaster Management Centre and therefore also all of the other components linked to the Disaster Management Act, which in effect will then provide various oversights and oversights from the executive or parliament to the executive as well. Currently, we see that the National Centre is, in my opinion, totally misplaced within the ministry, which makes the multi-sectoral, multidisciplinary nature of disaster management extremely problematic, and it impacts directly on the oversight role, as I mentioned. And a similar thing is happening, seeing that the National Centre is misplaced. It is now being misplaced on provincial and then also on local level as well, which makes the total implementation of the Act a bit problematic. So, Jay, in terms of the direct submission that was given, in conclusion, we do support parliamentary oversight in terms of what I've already mentioned. And we also believe that there needs to be some form of institutional protections in terms of parliament and courts should be included in the preamble of the Disaster Management Act. And lastly, as I mentioned, we also believe that the preamble should focus on the rights and certain parameters within the Bill of Rights linked to the preamble of the amendment of the legislation. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. Can we now ask the Helen Suzman Foundation? The Helen Suzman Foundation, yes.
Good morning, Chair. I am here. I can't get... Oh, there's the video. Yeah. I'm Anton van Dalsen. My title is Legal Counselor at the Helen Suzman Foundation. I have a presentation. May I put it on the screen to share with you? Chairperson?
Yes. Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning. I will do the presentation on behalf of the Helen Suzman Foundation, and I will speak to the notes which you will see on your screen. I think just a preliminary comment, and that is that it's accepted that the Disaster Management Act is an extremely important piece of legislation, as it gives government power to act quickly and decisively when confronted by a natural disaster. Now, it's important to note that neither the bill that is before you nor our comments place any limit or delay on government's power in declaring a national state of disaster or in the steps taken to confront it, because it's accepted that the power to take swift action in this context is absolutely necessary. The essential problems, as we see it, of the Disaster Management Act, the first problem is the minister is able to extend a national state of disaster indefinitely, a month at a time, without any say by Parliament. And the second problem is that the Disaster Management Act makes no provision for parliamentary oversight. And here I can just refer to the constitutional requirements or obligations of Parliament in this regard, which are set out in sections 42 and 55 of the Constitution. So in our view, those are the two essential problems that we are faced with. The Disaster Management Act Amendment Bill. Now, the bill addresses the two problems which I've just mentioned, and this relates to Parliament's role in extending a national state of disaster and the approval of regulations or directions. And the bill provides, as we know, for similar changes on provincial and municipal levels as well. Now, we support the changes proposed in the bill against the background of the two basic problems, as we see it, of the DMA, except that we would propose a simple majority for extensions to a national state of disaster, and not the 60% majority which is contained in the bill. And a number of these provisions in the bill have just been taken over from the state of emergency provisions in the Constitution. But for a state of natural disaster, we feel that a simple majority would be sufficient. And in conclusion, I think, and it's important to emphasize these points, Parliament, and in this case the National Assembly, fulfill its constitutional obligations to Herb General, but more particularly where it concerns a matter of such importance as a national state of disaster. And I can just mention that occasional briefings by ministers to portfolio committees, in our view, do not constitute sufficient oversight. We feel that's a very important point that needs to be underlined, and that Parliament as a whole must play its oversight role in this regard. And the bill places a formal obligation on the National Assembly in respect of both extensions and regulations issued under a national state of disaster. And I think it's here very important to emphasize that these obligations that are being are proposed to be placed on the National Assembly do not limit or delay government's ability to act quickly when confronted by a natural disaster, but what they do is they give the National Assembly a role in effectively ratifying these decisions by government and approving them after the event. So that, together with Parliament's obligation of oversight of executive power, this is very important in that context, and for that reason we support the provisions of the bill where they address the oversight role of Parliament and the role of Parliament in the initial approving the initial declaration of a national state of disaster and extensions to that. Chairperson, so that is my presentation. If anyone has any comments or questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thank you.
No, we will be raising questions soon. Can we now ask PS South Africa to make a presentation? PSA. If BASA is not in, can we get Solidarity?
Morning, Chair. I am here.
Yeah. You are from?
If I can see the presentation of the previous speaker is still on the screen.
You must remove it. You can go ahead, Solidarity.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. First of all, good morning, everybody. I would just like to state that we've been taught when one gives a presentation is to look presentable. However, I request the indulgence of the committee if I may remove my jacket, if you don't mind.
Yes, you can.
Thank you very much. I really like to extend my thanks to the chairperson, then also to the honourable members of the committee for the opportunity to present, first of all, our written submission to Parliament on the Disaster Management Amendment Bill, and now also be afforded the time to present our oral submission in person before you. Thirdly, I must note, and this is very important, that this submission serves as a supplementary. Our main submission is in front of you, and we don't need to repeat that due to obvious time constraints. Secondly, to assist the committee, we would keep our submission brief, concise, and to the point, And then obviously, I believe as a chairperson, et cetera, so questions will be afterwards. So we will then also be available for that. Now the framework of our submission consists of two parts. Firstly, in the first part, we will briefly look at our main submission and a few important points made in that written submission. And the second part, we want to answer three questions before arriving at our conclusion. So let's start on the first part. In our written submission, we have dealt with the relevant legislation and then also the sections applicable, which obviously is the Disaster Management Act, the State of Emergency Act, the Constitution, which is Section 37, and then as well as proposed Disaster Management Amendment Bill. We have given an overview and differentiated as putting emphasis on three points, but it needs to be repeated here. The first point, and firstly, is the powers of the executive and parliamentary oversight. Secondly, the duration, lasting, termination, and then also the extension of a state of disaster and state of emergency. And thirdly and lastly, we look at the most important factor we fight is the limitation on basic human rights. Now, for purposes of the second part of our submission, Jay, the three differences, if any, needs to be highlighted. On the first point, the Disaster Management Act provides for no parliamentary oversight and supervision, except for an annual report that the Minister has to table that she receives from the National Centre, an annual report tabled to Parliament. As far as the Disaster Management Act goes, this is the only supervision or oversight function that Parliament has. Has been opposed to the State of Emergency Act, where there is a clear and very importantly oversight function for Parliament, where it can hold the executive accountable. This means we go to the second point. Yes, obviously there are differences in the duration, the lapsing, the termination and the extension of a state of disaster and the state of emergency. Yes, we agree them to up to that. But most importantly, the limitation on human rights and civil liberties are present in both cases. This condition is clearly explained in our written submission, and I refer you to paragraph 43 to 49 and paragraph 60 to 62 in our written submission. This brings us now to our second part of our submissions, where we want to answer three questions. Three questions only. First question, if we find that basic human rights are limited in both state of disaster and state of emergency, is the Disaster Management Act then constitutional? And the answer is yes. The Disaster Management Act is constitutional. So too is the Declaration of State of Disaster and 7, which forms part of the Amendment Bill seeks to amend. Two cases, Freedom Front Plus versus the President of the Republic of South Africa and the Democratic Alliance versus Minister of COSA, the Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, where both courts have ruled that indeed, yes, it is constitutional, albeit for a minority judgment in the Democratic Alliance case of Judge Montagnani. Interestingly though, and I think that this is pointed out, that in the case of the Freedom Front Plus, a differentiation was made on the limitation during state of disaster and the state of emergency by stating that only during state of emergency is parliamentary oversight. However, your fundamental rights in Chapter 2 of the Constitution are merely limited, as in this treaty's Section 36, which is the Limitation Clause. However, when one looks at the Constitution, one will find that the Constitution in Section 37.4 subsection 5 makes neither mention of the word suspension nor limitation. In fact, the word used is derogation, which means to deviate from. This leads us then to our second question. Why? Only during a state of disaster is only the executive and the judiciary, as part of the three spheres of government, before its oversight functions. And in always, when one asks the question why, it one needs to answer the question why not. Do we ask why not Parliament as well? Why is Parliament clearly sidestepped during a state of disaster and not during a state of emergency? And the answer is for no reason at all. And to prove this point, one only needs to consider to show how only the courts here have oversight powers. And we also here have two cases. One being Pasa versus the Minister of COFSA, and then the of Costa. Now in Basa, a clear violation of the applicant's fundamental rights was at play, and therefore Regulation 45 was found to be unconstitutional. And in Minister versus the Beer, which is discussed in our written submission already, where the applicant successfully relied on Section 36. The last question then that we ask is, considering all this, whether the Disaster Management Act is constitutional or not, it does not matter. What one can see, and the question then is, how one can one then remedy this clear and obvious void of the no parliamentary oversight and supervision, with only the judiciary can make the finding on the application of Section 36. And then the most obvious and promising answer is the Disaster Management Amendment Bill. When one looks at the proposed Disaster Management Amendment Bill, one finds that it is a mere and simple and effortless mirroring of applicable legislation that already exists in the state of emergency and in also in the Constitution. And this brings us to our conclusion of our written submission on the last three paragraphs. And if you allow me, I'll read that. The last three paragraphs of our written submission, and I can refer to paragraph 105, 106 and 107, and I'm going to read it. The submission is therefore based on the clear lack of supervision and proper preemptive and current checks and balances over the executive's power by Parliament during a state of disaster. We therefore find that the proposed amendments are sufficiently founded. As we have witnessed, to leave such powers to only the judiciary to make a ruling on the application of Section 36 of the Constitution and for the validity of a declaration of a state of disaster, any extension of a declaration of a disaster, state of disaster, or any legislation enacted or other actions taken in consequence of a declaration of a state of disaster, but retrospective. And this is the second last point that I wish to make. We are only able to do so now because of what the case recently heard, is that the problem of retrospectively is when an aggrieved party approaches the court to seek a remedy ex post facto on, I believe, the 23rd August until the 26th of August, and judgment still is reserved. However, in her submission, on behalf of government, senior counsel Nazreen Bauer argued that every time restrictions were announced, Vinsberg challenged them, and by the time the challenge reached the court, it has become an academic exercise. Therefore, lastly and in conclusion, the Disaster Management Amendment Bill and proposed amendments are they indeed sufficiently founded, and the limitation on civil liberties and human rights need to be safeguarded. If we agree, the courts can and do play a vital role in safeguarding human rights. But this is the emphasis. A more proactive and engaged oversight by Parliament is needed. Hence, our full support of the Disaster Management Amendment Bill, and then this concludes our submission. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That now ends the session of presentation. We will now allow honorable members, this is your time for discussion and questions, and I'm sure the presenters will be taking notes, and when the time comes for them to respond, they will do so. I'm now looking at the hands for honorable members. I see the hand of Honorable Brink, you are number one. Honorable Teza, you are number two. For now, I see only those two hands. Oh, the third one is Honorable Direko. So in that case, Honorable Brink.
Can I ask your permission to switch my video feed off, because I don't think my internet connectivity is great here, and that's going to affect
me. In fact, it's the same with me. It's the same with me. You can do so.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Chair, just in general, I think we will have regard to the written representations, but the interactions with the different stakeholders is also very valuable, especially to present questions on new information that is presented to us that can't be commented on separately. My first question is in order of the presentations to Ms. Ellebeck from 4SA, referred in the recommendation to compulsory public consultation, and she also referred to case law. Perhaps if she could just give us the full citation of that case. I did make a note, but I didn't exactly get that full citation of what that case is, because I think it's important to refer to it. My question would just be, where would the public consultation process come in the view of 4SA? Would it be after the minister has issued regulations pursuant to the declaration of a national state of disaster, and before those regulations come into effect, a type of a consultation period, say 7 days or 14 days, I'm not quite sure, but perhaps 4SA can just give us an idea of where that sort of public consultation can come in, because I think it's a compelling point, not just in respect of the content of declarations or regulations issued pursuant to a declaration, but also maybe the decision to extend a national state of disaster. Then for NUMSA's representative, Ms. Roy, I just need to understand, NUMSA is not in favor of the 3 month extension of the national state of disaster, as contemplated in the draft legislation, the bill, what would NUMSA feel would be a more appropriate time period for extensions, given that all of the other proposed would come back and to reconsider the extension of a national state of disaster, if not 3 months? And then she referred to the idea that there should be consultation with specific bodies, and she mentioned NEDLAC, presuming that she meant by the executive before a national state of disaster declaration is made and the content of the regulations. Is the proposal NEDLAC specifically, or should there be a broader range of organizations? And just more broadly, would this objective not be met by broader public consultation in the way that Parliament consults over a draft legislation, even if it is an abridged period? Then to Mr. Becker from the Disaster Management Institute of Southern Africa. And he mentions that the bill is not in keeping with the spirit of the Act. I would just want to know, does he think, and does the Institute think, that it was ever the intention of the legislation to be used as it is currently being used? So for more than a year, South Africa has been governed under a state of national disaster. Parliament has got no say in the extension or the termination of that state of national disaster. Parliament has no say over the content of regulations and directives pursuant to that declaration. Was that the intention of the legislation? He also refers to what he calls a bureaucratic process that would need to be followed if this bill before us is passed. Is it not more appropriate to refer to a democratic process? Because the process that we currently have is bureaucratic in the sense of officials and members of the executive making decisions. What this would impose is parliamentary oversight, which is not a bureaucratic process. Then, the other problem that I would like Mr. Becker to comment on is what we've heard from other organizations is that to get to the reasoning behind the regulation, for example, South Africa had to go, there wasn't easy access by the public to the reasons and the scientific information. And in some of these instances, in the cigarette ban case would be one example, it was actually found that the ban on the sale of cigarettes was based on erroneous scientific information or an erroneous interpretation of scientific information. And is it really fair to expect South Africans to go to court in each instance to establish whether that's in fact the case? Then lastly, to Mr. Becker, the second last question to him, has his organization done any research on other democratic jurisdictions where Parliament, the legislature, has got absolutely no say in the declaration of a state of national disaster or emergency, as the case may be, to deal with disasters, as well as the content of regulations issued under such a declaration? Are there other jurisdictions that have absolutely no place for elected representatives? Then the last question to him is, he speaks about inadequate preparation for possible disasters, and he says that this might be the problem. My question to him would be, that if the National Disaster Management Center were aware in advance of the procedural constraints on taking action under a national state of disaster, would that not prompt them to do proper preparation instead of depending on making decisions on the fly? Then, Chairperson, to Professor Van Niekerk, I would just want to know, you referred to a specific provision of the Act that's not properly being used, an advisory forum. Can you just give us the particulars of that? Because I don't think I got the section of the Act that he was referring to. And then as to the suggestion about putting the National Disaster Management Center in the presidency instead of COGTA, I would just want to know how exactly is that going to improve oversight? Maybe I missed that point. Then to Mr. Van Dalsen of the Helen Suzman Foundation, we do not require a special majority of national disaster as contemplated by this bill. But would he not say, as others have before us, that a state of national disaster is analogous to a state of emergency in the sense that the lawmaking powers of Parliament are subsumed for a limited purpose and a limited period by the executive, and that this has an effect on fundamental rights, and therefore the same procedural constraints that should apply to a state of emergency should apply to a state of disaster, and that at present includes the requirement of a two-thirds parliamentary majority. What would you say to that argument? That is all for now. Thanks very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Pelva.
No. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to be very brief because it's not necessary to be that long, Chairperson, on this presentation. It's not necessary at all. I want to put it categorically clear that a state of disaster, Chair, is where there is a risk of there is a serious risk of health, and thus the need for the curtailment of the virus itself. And so these reactionary presentations that are coming from a predominantly white representation that have come here are not very far from the previous tourism industry that submitted here when you were not here, Chairperson. I don't know why they waited for the disaster to happen in order to raise these issues. Maybe they can explain that to us. What would have been an ideal situation before a disaster and in a post-disaster situation? We are in a state of disaster, Chairperson, and the situation is abnormal as it is, which includes that there should be a power that comes from the ministry, which is a custodian of the Disaster Management Act, to quarantine people, prohibit gatherings, impose restrictions on movement of the people in order to protect health. And now it has affected people across the sector of this, which is proposed here. Soldiers were sent to townships and in rural areas to enforce these regulations. And given the spatial development of those areas and the extension of the families, the situation was way abnormal before the disaster. It would have been treated by a government that is willing to resolve apartheid spatial development to ensure that people have adequate houses. They are not cluttered and they are not overly populated, and they can easily kill each other and hate each other without any alarm from the state. And so it's just that it the privileged Indians have killed blacks while blacks were scrounging for food during the disaster. You know, what interests us is that amongst the members of the National Corona Command Council is the procurement process where wrong vaccines were procured in India during this period. And the PPE inavailability in restaurants, in many businesses, and the working class having to be subjected to and be susceptible to the coronavirus, and without any alarm, again, due to inequalities, due to massive poverty and desperation of our people, in a country where there is a majority that is going to vote again in local government elections, and without any alarm again, there is not going to be changes that seek to then change the situation, the economic situation of the people, of the majority. And so South Africa is not a two nations, Chair. It is one capitalist country whose racialized capitalism places certain racial groups at a certain points of production within the capitalist system. Within basic common sense, as revealed by Marxist-Leninist characterization of the state capitalist class divisions, our people are not able to speak about 11 billion and 18 billion per annum losses and all those things. They are not able to have lost during this period. Not even anything without being subjected to the violence of police in a democratic society. And you have an all-white representation advocating that it should have been otherwise. So they must then tell us, Chairperson, that perhaps the extensions that they are proposing, how they are going to change the material conditions of our people. Because we are sick and tired up to here, Chairperson, to having to talk about these issues when they are actually not seen to be done. And a capitalist economy like South Africa's is inevitably dependent on exploitation of the poor laborers. It is seen in the restaurants there in Dalstrom. It is seen in restaurants there that are white owned, you know, and that are abusing workers to work day and night on the basis of that. They are cleaning the restaurant, and we're not speaking to that. We're not speaking to how these changes must happen. We're not going to speak to their conscience yet. Expropriation of land must come quickly. That expropriation bill, Chair, they are saying is ready. It must come where there is nil compensation, so that our people do not listen to things like games and those things of games and trophies and trophy hunting, which is not speaking to the SMMEs, the emerging SMMEs within that those sectors, and transformation and all sorts of disasters within those sectors. So I propose that, Chairperson, then that the South African hunters can just explain their transformative action and how they seek to change those, and then in terms of the research of by the tourism research and environment society, 300,000 consumptive hunters in South Africa, of that 300,000, how many are black? That's South African hunters. And in terms of the skills development and the access to land within those SMMEs, how many have and given access to land? And if what is the reason for those things? And then I see.
see the secondary contributions in terms of live capture and translocation services, veterinarian. I see all those things within the wide ranking there. But I want to speak to these reactions that have been raised by the sectors. Must then put into serious consideration and whether they have put into serious consideration that scientific evidence of what they are proposing would obtain. How would it obtain, in fact? Because the professor who spoke earlier on actually has the experience of he even acknowledged the origins of the disaster management. Why was this not raised before? I think, Chairperson, I spoke to the special development issues, the issues of consultation. I spoke to them. And the issues of rapid response in terms of curtailment of the virus itself, and of course oversight and accountability. Some of the issues relate to the sector departments and would have been better expressed on their ability to then do this. For now, Chairperson, thank you very much.
Honorable Direko.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there's no doubt that COVID-19 has affected many industries and our economy. People have lost jobs and many companies have closed down. We also take into account the fact that disasters are unique in its form, and the amendment of the disaster isn't only applicable for COVID-19, but also to the future disasters that may happen in our country. Chair, on COVID-19, and government has to strike balance between health and health to be limited in order to assist and protect the public, provide relief for the public, and also to prevent some other things that could have happened during this disaster. Should some of the regulation not be taken into account, we could have lost more than this number that I've just indicated. And we also need to understand that economy has been affected, but economy can be recovered. The unfortunate part is that those who have lost their life cannot be returned to life again. So most of our stakeholders that have presented, some of them are talking about oversight. So I would like to understand the kind of oversight that they are referring to. The reason why I'm asking is because currently in Parliament, we are having portfolio committees that are responsible for holding executive accountable. And then the other stakeholder, I can't remember which one, one of the stakeholders raised a concern about the lack of inclusive consultation, of which I believe that one is a matter of concern. So what could be the possible solution to this matter? Does the current amendment speak to the matter, to that matter of inclusive consultation? And then on 4SA, on their recommendation, they spoke about the requiring Parliament to debate whether the proposed regulations are rationally connected to the scientific data. So should this debate be before or after the regulations are published? And then on the Disaster Management Institute of the Southern Africa, in their presentation, they raised concern regarding the amendment, including the 60% of majority. So I would like to check with them, what could be the most effective way of dealing with the disaster to complement the current Disaster Management Act instead of over-regulating it? Thank you, Chair. I'm fine. I'm done.
Honorable Spies.
Yes, Oliver Chair, can you?
Yes.
Honourable Chairperson, I just want to say that we understand, and I think that is, you know, amongst us all common, that transformation will always remain an issue. And I've listened to my colleagues, and I want to say the following, Chairperson. The issue here and the common thread that I've observed through every presentation, whether it comes from one category of people, race, is that every person who's presented has emphasized that on their various industries, and how that translated in them, you know, losing jobs in that industry. And as much as we can go on that the people who've presented have just been white, we must admit that a lot of the people in the industries are also people that are not from the same color, and they are the people who have been affected. I mean, if you look at the hunting industry, you know, 18,000 jobs times six, it's 108,000 people who've lost their jobs, who are not going to get their jobs back, because even pre-COVID, we had issues with employment, you know, statistics, and that we are struggling as a country to increase that, you know, to decrease the employment percentage. So people are still going to lose their jobs. People are losing their jobs as we speak. So we must understand the importance of what is said here. Besides that a white woman or a white man is making the presentation, the fact is our people are losing their jobs. We see it, we know it, we know such people, we hear it. They come to us, people are stranded, they don't know what to do. I accept that we must address the transformation issues. But the bottom line here is, people are losing their jobs. And it's the very people that we say that we are fighting for that are losing their jobs. Thank you, Chairperson. I needed to make that comment.
Very much. I think we will now allow the different stakeholders to respond, make comments, and I think we have generally noted your presentations to start with. We'll find time as a committee to go through them and integrate them into the public responses that we asked for. But can we allow you to respond?
Honourable Chairperson, if I can respond to the questions directed to Forest A by Honourable Brink and Honourable Dereko. Honourable Brink, you asked about when the public participation would happen. In our view, it would be best if the public participation happens even, it doesn't have to even be in the form of written submission, but between the declaration of disaster and the coming into effect of the regulation. With regards to that, shared in the chat box with everyone, including a link to where the case can be found on SASE, has actually said that, you know, in that case which had to do with the level 4 regulations, even just affording a 2-day period to members of the public to make representations would have been sufficient. Obviously, the length of time and form of public submissions would depend on the context. But the principle is public participation, and the test is fundamental fairness. Regarding to Honourable Dereko's question relating to when Parliament would debate the different things such as with the regulations are rationally connected and so forth, that is set forth in our written submission, specifically paragraphs 15 through 17. However, that would occur whenever Parliament is considering extending the state of disaster. And I'll hand over to my colleague, Patsy Barnhorst, if she has anything to add to these answers.
Thank you, Danella. I would just like the opportunity to respond to Honourable Teza's question
on why these issues have not been raised before. Chair, in response to that question, I would just like to pass on record also that 4SA has indeed on at least three occasions formally petitioned or raised these issues with this particular committee. The first was on 20 May 2020 when 4SA petitioned this particular committee in relation to the COVID-19 regulations and the impact thereof on the religious community, and as a result of that, the discussion was also facilitated by this community between 4SA and the COGTA minister. We then, again, on invitation of this committee, who said that they were the custodians of the Disaster Management Act, and invited us to come back to this committee should our queries not be responded to by the COGTA ministry. We sent a second petition in relation to the very same issues to the COGTA committee on the 10th of November 2020, so that was the second occasion, and then the third occasion on which these issues, very similar issues, were raised was most recently on the 22nd of April 2021, when this committee called for representations and in fact facilitated a discussion with the National Disaster Management Center, whereby people could ask questions and then the centre was going to respond. So it's not the first time that these issues are being raised by 4SA. They have been raised consistently in writing, and we are thankful for that. The issue of representation, I would just like to point out as before that in the last year and a half on this issue of the COVID-19 regulations, 4SA was mandated in writing by religious leaders and organizations representing between 11 and 18.5 million people. And those people are not white people only. They include a constituency of 10 million people from the African Indigenous and Spirituality churches, and indeed from across the spectrum of churches, denominations, and faith groups. So, well, you know, unfortunately, myself and my colleague who are representing here today, it's true that we are white. Our constituency spans people of all colours and backgrounds. And then just on the question directed by the Honourable Director of the ANC on the issue of what kind of oversight is contemplated, well, the kind of oversight that is contemplated, Chair, is oversight by this particular committee as a custodian, in the own words, of the Disaster Management Act. A constitutional democracy, such as we are in South Africa, contemplates a system of checks and balances. And the legislature, this committee in particular, as a portfolio committee of parliament, is that check and balance on the executive. They are the ones to examine whether, firstly, there are good reasons for the regulations that are issued by the executive, and secondly, whether it's happening in accordance with a fair process, because that is, in fact, what is demanded by our constitution. And so therefore Parliament, and in particular this committee as the legislative body, needs to ensure that whatever regulations are passed by the executive are both lawful in terms of the way in which they're being passed for rational reasons and are indeed constitutional. And that would include that they, to the extent that any fundamental rights are limited in terms of Section 36, that they do meet the test for reasonableness and justifiability in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution. That is really the job of this committee as the representatives of the people of South Africa and also the legislative body who is that check and balance on the executive. I trust that will answer the questions. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. The next respondent, Nomsa, I did hear your name getting mentioned.
Yes, Chair. Thank you. So, in response to Honourable Brink's question, if I articulated correctly what he asked, was that the time frame was much to be defined. And well, the reason for this is that we based on the national consultation processes that needed to be taken place. And these consultation processes would then inform a suitable time frame. So hence we have not put a suitable time frame forward, taking into account that the relevant stakeholders have not been consulted with. And when we say relevant stakeholders, in relation to your second question, you mentioned, is it specifically related to NEDLAC? And the answer to that would be no. We would feel that all stakeholders should be included in the discussions for the DMA, and this would include civil society organizations, Center for Inequality Studies, the informal sector economy stakeholders, and all other stakeholders, for example, student-based organizations as well, so that we can be able to put forward a suitable model that will accompany a suitable time frame. And these decisions would be based on the readiness of the infrastructure based on what is available and the readiness to be able to accommodate the state of disaster for however time frame is then stipulated. I hope, Chair and Honourable Brink, that I've managed to answer your question effectively. Thank you.
Dimsa, can you respond?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm having problems getting my visuals up. Thank you very much. To respond to the questions by the Honourable Brink, the first question is the spirit of the Disaster Management Act. The spirit of the Act is not only about the post-disaster response. There is a need to do the pre-planning before the disaster happens, and that must be based on a comprehensive disaster risk, vulnerability, and capacity assessment. And, Chair, in the 20 years that we've had this legislation, very little has been done in that regard. And that is why decisions were made on the run and the need for rapidly changing regulations. One that springs to mind is the transport industry, where we had about four different capacities for minibus taxis promulgated within a period of a week. The Disaster Management Act is very important because it says the existing legislation cannot cope, it is not a disaster. So our planning needs to be addressing the over and above what is covered in terms of other legislation. And that should happen long before. Your consultation processes should be taking place prior to the disaster occurring so that there's agreement as to how this will be implemented. And there's time to debate and consider in a non-stressful situation to make these decisions at the crux of a disaster when there's stress and an urgency to perform is not the time to be making these decisions. Chair, the use of the word bureaucratic was used in the second sense of the word, or the second use of the word, and that is an excessively complicated administrative process, which is also a definition of bureaucratic. I did not use it in the context of autocratic, bureaucratic, and democratic. The question of other declarations, Chair, the countries that we have looked at, India has a very similar, in fact, they've adopted the South African Disaster Management Act. So India's application is in terms of their Disaster Management Act. But most of your European countries do not have disaster legislation. The United States legislation is covered by the state of emergency side, and they do not have a specific disaster regulation. FEMA or the National Federal Emergency Management Agency actually falls under Homeland Security in the United States. So we are fairly unique, and I think the concept that we have is aligned to the United Nations thinking of a holistic approach of pre- and post-disaster management. And then, Chair, what is evident from most of the presentations here today is that disasters have a long-term socio-economic impact, and that needs to be addressed if you deal with that disaster and the disasters of the socio-economic consequences of COVID-19 for many years to come. And we need to take cognizance of that, and we, even at this stage, should already be planning of how we're going to revitalize students that have not attended classes for 2 years. The economic impacts of households that have lost breadwinners, the impact of people not contributing to pension funds, that will have a major impact on the fiscus of the country in years to come. And then, Chair, in response to the Honourable Durko, the question is not to over-regulate. The solution lies in emphasising the need to pre-plan and to address issues before the need to implement them. That approval can be given by Parliament if these plans are submitted to Parliament for pre-approval. And legislation is an enabling tool to allow action to be taken rapidly and to go through long public consultation processes and approvals that require debate are not conducive to that rapid response to disasters. I trust, Chair, that has answered the question from the Honourable Members.
Can we now ask Professor Van Niekerk?
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to answer the first part of the question. My colleague, Professor Bamindu Plessis, is online, so she will field the question around the placement of the National Centre within the presidency. Chair, first and foremost, I would like to emphasize, and I think this is very important for the Portfolio Committee to always remember taking your work forward, is that although we call it the Disaster Management Act, the emphasis here is on disaster risk management and disaster risk reduction. Therefore, our focus must be on risk. And if we have a long-term perspective on risk, it is safeguarding our development. Disaster risk reduction at the end of the day must ensure that natural and anthropogenic or human-made hazards does not translate into what we call disaster to think of in the implementation of the Act and all of that. So logic says if we are successful in disaster risk reduction, then at the end of the day we won't have disasters, and therefore we won't have these type of discussions, okay, in the ideal world. The emphasis of the Disaster Management Act has always been on cooperative governance as well. If you read the Green Paper, if you read the White Paper, if you read the four consecutive first bills that came out, there's been a major emphasis on cooperative governance. And to answer the question of Honourable Brink, the section that I'm referring to is actually two. Section 4 and Section 5 of the Disaster Management Act as amended. Section 4 talks about the Interdepartmental Committee on Disaster Risk Management or Disaster Management. And more information on that committee is also contained in Section 1.1 of the National Disaster Management Framework, which should be our official policy on disaster management, as it is called for within the Disaster Management Act. Now, within the ICDM, there are certain structures or certain composition of the ICDM that must be in place. It's a structure that is supposed to be set up by the President, and it's supposed to, according to the national framework, sit every quarter. And the idea of the ICDM is to ensure this whole focus on cooperative governance. And it contains members of or ministers of certain departments as listed, MECs, representatives from local government, as in SALGA, traditional leaders, etc. So the net is thrown quite wide in terms of the ICBM. And we would also then expect that enhances corporate governance and also enhances our accountability mechanism. The second one that is very important is the advisory forums. Now, we have national disaster management advisory forums, provincial and then also local, which could feature at municipal and at district and metro level as well. And the idea of the municipal disaster management or the disaster management advisory forum is to bring in civil society and other role players to also have a say and input into disaster risk management on that specific administrative unit. So those are the two important ones. If you read the disaster management framework, section 1.1 following on gives a lot more information on what is the requirement and that the ICDM, for instance, is accountable to Cabinet and the reporting and the National Disaster Management Advisory Forum must be constituted by the National Disaster Management Center, etc. So I think it's quite well spelled out in our hands. So I hope that answers the question. We proceed to answer the question on the placement of the NDC and how this improves oversight. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Dierwald, and I just want to apologize for not being able to present. I was with your colleagues in Public Works presenting on expropriation bill, so I was quite surprised about the comment about the expropriation bill in this committee. But nevertheless, the suggestion that it be moved to the presidency and not under COGDA, if you read the aim of the bill, it says that it's there to provide for integrated and coordinated disaster management policy. And then it focuses on all these things. So the, I think Dierwald also alluded to that when the act was written, the idea was that it will go to the presidency because it makes the oversight just easier. Since all these issues in disaster management is cross-sectorial and multidisciplinary, it might be a problem if it's under a specific ministry. So there's also, I think, a reason why a state of emergency, for instance, rests with the president. It just provides for easier oversight functions and to dip into different ministries. I think that's also why the National Corona Command Council was established in Cabinet, because it dips into the different ministries. So it just seems more logical. It also then plays down into the office of the Premier and the office of the Municipal Manager instead of where we often find on local level the disaster management centre sitting in obscure places because it's not the responsibility of the Municipal Manager. The question about the portfolio committee, I've also wondered about that. I've seen in all the court cases that the courts were all right with it, that there's oversight from Parliament in the form of a portfolio committee. But in my opinion, that is true, so there is oversight, and committees are supposed to hold accountable. But it's not in legislation that allows for formal inputs or allows for the rejection or inputs into the regulations from any person in the National Assembly that might also not be on the committee. So I think there's just better oversight. I think also requiring some form of debate in the National Assembly brings it out in the open, and just facilitate the transparency that is also required by Section 1 in our Constitution. So on the other questions that were raised or issues that were raised, I'm just quickly going to address it because I don't want to overlap with what other people said already. But when we saw it as a private members bill introduced by the Freedom Front Plus, we did have some worries, should we comment or not, is this going to be taken serious? We are well aware of the politics, but I think it's our obligation as citizens, it's a proper bill, it's properly introduced, to comment on this, and I really hope, because there are issues with the disaster management, to not obscure the need to actually reassess the disaster management and to refine it where it is problematic, where we do find it to be problematic. So just to then latch on to what Mr. Becker said, that we must not lose sight that the Disaster Management Act is actually development legislation with a strong social justice focus. So one of our suggestions in the written submission is to clarify in the preamble, also to clarify the human rights involved in doing disaster management, and it requires that we make you know, the vulnerable people strong so that when there's a hazard, it doesn't turn into a disaster. And not just during disasters, but also before anything hazardous happens. So it is an act that not only enables, but actually demands that we look at vulnerable people. And it is up to us as citizens and to make sure that it's properly implemented, but it's also up to the Parliament to ensure proper implementation. And I hope all these issues that are being discussed here today aid in that process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can we allow solidarity if there's anything? And Helen Suzman Foundation, if there's anything that you think you want to comment on?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd just like to respond to a specific question which was raised by the Honourable Celia Brink, and that relates to our suggestion that a simple majority should be required for extensions of a state of disaster and not the 60% as is contained in the bill. And I think the answer to that very briefly is simply that a state of emergency, which does require 60% in terms of the Constitution for extensions, we're talking of situations with different dimensions, a state of emergency on the one hand and a state of national disaster on the other. The state of emergency, and you can it comes out very clearly in the Constitution, the state of emergency provisions in the Constitution effectively envisages infringing the Bill of Rights. It raises issues like detention without trial, in those words, in the Constitution. And I think it becomes very clear if you look at the Constitution in Section 37, where it says that a state of emergency is necessary to restore peace and, as I said, take on different dimensions, a state of natural disaster. And for that reason, we feel that a simple majority is sufficient for present purposes and that the higher majority, the 60% majority, should be limited to a state of emergency, which addresses and focuses on a completely different or a much more serious situation. So those are my comments to that question. Thank you.
To Honourable Fred Comfort, I see your hand.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, sir. I speak on behalf of SI Hunters. With all due respect, the questions around or the comments around the number of 300,000 hunters in the country, I merely quoted research done by the Trees Unit of the Northwest University. I actually checked the research report. There's no differentiation made between race groups in the report, so I can unfortunately not tell you how many of those hunters are white or black or colored or Indian. Just I have no information on race groups. However, what I did tell you is that in the first 3 months of the total lockdown in March to May last year, 18,000 jobs were lost in the game and hunt industry. I can with certainty tell you that by far the majority of those jobs that were lost were held by black people. They were the ones that lost out in this process. And that is what we're arguing about. Because hunters were not allowed to go hunting to consume the meat eventually, 18,000, and let's call it black people or non-white people, I don't want to be a racist around this, use whichever term you prefer, but 18,000 people lost their jobs. Each one of them took care of another five people to get to six in the household. So you sit with just over 100,000 people that have no income today. As a result of that lockdown, that was the message that I attempted to convey, and that is why we support the principle of better oversight and wider consultation before decisions are taken that may have a long-term impact and will definitely impact the lives of people who cannot afford to have such impact. only comment I would like to make. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Now we have beer South Africa that could not get. I think they should know now. We are in terms of time, and I'm sure they have listened to some of the questions that have been asked. Can I allow BA South Africa to say something?
Thank
you, Chair. Thanks, Chair. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Chair, is it possible for me to share screen? Thank you. Chair, I will try and be short and not to hold everyone too back. So I'll get straight into my presentation. I may need to put the camera off, the weather isn't too good. So I think I just want to appreciate the opportunity to chair and the portfolio committee, not only for today, but I think just for the great work that has been done from the onset of the pandemic. We understand that it has been an extremely stressful situation and a stressful period for all of us as South Africans, but especially you who have been sitting in the hot seat making these tough decisions, because none of us could have anticipated what was to come or have been prepared for this. And so decisions had to be made, and a very quick decision. So for me, I think the best thing about these crisis situations is the learning that takes place. And we have to take the learnings and be able to move forward from that. And that is with the spirit within which I make this presentation today on behalf of the Beer Association. As ships, this is the SAB South African Breweries, the Craft Brewer Association of South Africa, which represents over 200 members, Heineken South Africa. And then we have various partners in our value chain, all the way from barley to beer. And this is where we call barley, which is our agriculture, which is our hops, our barley, where we move into malting. We also have our feed, which goes to pig farmers. We also then move into the entire value chain, which is our then suppliers, fleets that transport our goods, as well as our packaging, all the way to our tavern owners, our retailers, and then to the consumers. In terms of our contribution, Chair, I think it is clear here on this slide in terms of the jobs that we support as the beer industry. Overall, as the alcohol industry, it is 1 million livelihoods that we support. And when you look at the township economy as well, it is over 265,000. I just want to raise here, Chair, on this point that I'm not people of the economy. There are over 50% of these black women, and they support not only their own households, but at least 10 different households in that community. In terms of our GDP contribution as well, it's looking at over 387.1 billion, which is over 1.3% towards the GDP of the country. In terms of the effect that the Disaster Management Act has had on the alcohol industry, alcohol is the only product mentioned in the Disaster Management Act, and you can look at that section 27.2.1, and it speaks about the suspension and limiting of the sale, and I think everyone is aware of this provision. And the issue of the targeting of our industry has been dealt with by many cases. There's been a reference to a Vimpro case, but there's also been an SAB case, which is one of our members. So I don't want to get into that. But what is concerning for us, Chair, is that the impact has been disastrous on us in that further to us being, we feel, only being mentioned and only being targeted, we have not had the benefit of being consulted, being the only industry that is being mentioned. And I will talk about then what it is that we would like. But if you look at the impact of the national disaster, we suffered as an industry a loss of 23 weeks, 161 days of trade in the industry. And that value chain that I spoke about from barley to bar was included in that. And you will see here in terms of the jobs at where we looked at risk, and also the disinvestment in the country. We had our SAB and Heineken's, where we looked at over 6 million rand of disinvestment in
the country, we had over 450,000 jobs that could have been established by plants that were then discontinued from being developed. And our craft breweries, just to stress, this is where we have our local craft breweries. It is local companies where there are small businesses, SMMEs, and this is our transforming sector. So the likes of Apiwe, who is our first black brewmaster in the country, the first black woman to own a craft brewery, who has now shut her doors, which is very sad. We've had our people like Netu, who's opened up at the waterfront, who cannot pay his rental at the waterfront. We've had many cases of people, and these are young black entrepreneurs who have entered this trade, who've had to close their doors or who are on the brink of closing. The worst part about this is that we do not get any relief from government. Now, why is this important in terms of my submission? Is because, Chair, throughout this process, we have not been able to give our input into any of the processes. We feel transparency. There's been no public by the industry that is directly stated and linked and mentioned in the bill. We don't believe that in this current form, the Act provides sufficient legislative accountability and consultation with the very affected parties like us as the beer industry and alcohol industry as abroad. Because when we sit at the NEDLAC process, which we do have a seat and we're appreciative of that, we are not able to make submissions to the Honourable Committee. Our submissions are not tabled. We do not get responses. We, like the rest of the country, have to sit and listen to the President's address. And also, in terms of any submissions, you and I believe the decisions are made in terms of reports that are submitted by the Medical Research Council, and often those reports are received from anti-alcohol lobbyists. And I believe that those are sometimes biased reports, yet the industry is not given an opportunity to present the reports that we may have or that are also commissioned. Then BARTA also believes that these amendments, the new amendments, seek to provide the oversight by legislative bodies at a national, provincial, and municipal level. BARTA believes that greater oversight nationally, provincially, and locally will positively influence government's ability for the unintended consequences of the disaster management policies, and more importantly, ensure the long-term sustainability of the affected industries. We are really at a point where we need to rebuild this alcohol sector. We need to rebuild the country, and we definitely need more transparency in terms of these regulations and the directions, because we don't know when this will be over, and we cannot continue month on month with uncertainty. Every time there is a lockdown, it is with immediate effect. We cannot plan in advance. Often our fleets are on the road, and then we are told that there is a lockdown. Our people in rural areas don't know when they need to return to work, when they are out perhaps on leave. It is definitely a difficult situation. We don't know when to deliver stock. Our taverns, for example, they would have bought stock and spent X amount of rand on their stock. They don't have cash flow at hand, and then their stock sits with them and the stock expires. And these are really logistical issues that I don't think are considered because they are not consulted. This amended Act needs to ensure that the accompanying regulations and directions do not have a severe unintended consequences on our business, which is what I've raised now. And so really our survival and recovery of our chain really relies on this, and we are really in support in terms of this amendment in particular, and we really are trying to promote. And this is where the transformation is taking place. And as I said, we do not receive relief. We do not qualify for UIF TERS. The President made an address, and he spoke about licenses and the relief that licenses, everyone will get on licenses. We try and apply for that. We are told by the National Liquor Authority that we do not qualify as alcohol. There's tourism grants. We do not qualify for that. So we're constantly not able to get relief as an industry. So I thank you, Chair, and I'm happy to take questions.
Before we ask questions, there's another speaker who has just joined us from KZN. I have noted the message, but I think I'm allowing him or her to say something before we can take further questions. The Deputy Minister as well has asked for to be excused at 12 for another meeting. Can I allow you, Honourable
Bishop Bernard?
It's very difficult to pronounce your surname.
Bishop, just call me Bishop Bernard. That's fine.
Bishop Bernard,
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you. I just would like to take this opportunity to greet the entire leadership that's here present. It's an honor and privilege to be here. As I've given you my name, it's Bishop Bernard Kupasamy. I am an executive council member for the Moral Regeneration Movement in the Etekweni region. I represent a huge proportion of the religious sector, and probably that's why I was invited into this meeting today. I've sent in a submission. I'm not too sure if it's reached the relevant department, but though I will resend it if needs be. I would just like to add my sentiments is just to add to what has already been said. Firstly, from the religious sector, my urgent plea is to say that the pandemic has really impacted the religious sector. It has really impacted the religious communities of the whole of South Africa. There is an outrage in the communities right now, referring to which was not really there. Probably it was just hiding away, but now it's beginning to surface. And therefore, this outrage needs to be addressed with immediate effect as the temperatures are moving high and low, especially here in KZN. The other thing I'd like to address is, Honorable Chair and leadership, is that we have found that through the pandemic there's been a gross violation of our human rights, especially to do with the religious sector and churches being treated in a very abrupt and very uncanny manner. So we'd really like some intervention from government, especially regarding the religious sector, because we are the foot soldiers. We are very actively involved in all the communities of South Africa. We are the first one to attend to the funerals, and also to attend to people who are on the sick in the sick beds. Some of them are dying with no attention. So the religious sector was declared by the president as we are also frontline workers. Why the sudden changes are coming with regards to the amendments, especially regarding or the COVID regulations regarding the churches, are suddenly beginning to take another direction, has now raised a lot of concerns, especially amongst prominent leaders from the religious sector. So these are some of my things that are really concerning. Some of the other issues, I shall put them onto the submission, and I'm really grateful and thankful that this opportunity, especially to do with taking care of disaster management in our communities, that the religious sector can be actively involved, because we know people that some of even the other sectors are not in contact with, and you don't really have communication with them. So we as the religious sector can be a pillar and a very strong arm both to the government and also to the business sector. Because if we look at the old unrest that took place, it actually had more to do with the economic situation and the bridging of the gap between the rich and the poor. So it was not a religious we went around burning others. So we see that, please, we would like to appeal to the Parliament Portfolio Committee, to COCTA, and to government that the religious sector need to be taken very, very seriously, as we don't want to lose the religious sector from being involved, especially with disaster management in our communities. So thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and the leadership of our country. God bless.
Thank you. I'm not sure now if I'm leaving anybody. I see the name of Miss Pillay. I'm not sure whether she was accompanying you, Bishop. Miss Pillay, is there any Miss Pillay who might
be? Not really, Honorable Chair. It's the first time I'm engaging on this level and meeting some new people. Though there might be some other members that probably recognize me through the National Interfaith Council, of which I am the president for the United Religious Bodies here in KwaZulu-Natal, and also I'm an executive council member for the Moral Regeneration Movement in eThekwini region. Thank
okay,
you.
John, let's allow Miss Patricia Pillay.
Chair, I've done the presentation. I'm from the Beer Association. I'm not linked to the bishop.
Honorable members, now this would be, if there are any follow-up questions you would want to ask, this would be your last round before we wind up the discussion. Any honorable members who would want to follow up? Okay. Can I assume that if there are no hands, it means you are all covered by the... Now, can I, as the chairperson of the committee, say thank you to all the presenters of this session? I think... besides the fact that we are focusing on a bill that is the center of our discussion here, but sharing some of these views that you have expressed in this session, I'm sure all the members are learning something out of the disaster, this COVID-19. We're still in that process of assessing the impact of the of COVID-19, and equally from what you have been saying, I think of everybody is focusing on saying we assess and we are planning as to how best we can recover from this destruction. In other words, there's none of us who is doubting that yes, there was this disaster. Managing it, we can never say it was perfect, and we are learning the lessons as we proceed. But as you would know, this was a global pandemic. We have been sharing views with everybody else, and so we can't at this moment claim that we have been dealing with this in the best way possible. So the bill itself, I think we have noted all the contributions, and they will get into the process. I think there are many lessons we are learning as people whose responsibility is to do oversight. When people talk about accountability, consultation, I know that it will never be enough to consult people. And even the impact of what we have, it will differ from one sector to the other. But I think those lessons are very critical as we are planning to see how best we can move forward. So with all the inputs that we have made, I think the parliamentary process is going to guide as to what will happen. Otherwise, thank you very much for the inputs, the lessons, and I'm definitely sure members of parliament will not be the same as when we started this process. Otherwise, we have come to the end. The meeting is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Chair.